From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum this morning, Stanford law professor and bioethicist Hank Greeley predicts that in as little as 20 years, most people in developed countries may not use sex to procreate. He sees a future where skin cells can be used to make an embryo and parents would prefer a baby made in the laboratory rather than the bedroom. We'll talk to Greeley about his book, The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. He joins us in studio for the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We're joined this Forum Hour by Stanford law professor and bioethicist Hank Greeley, author of a new book titled The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction, which actually foresees a future of laboratories replacing bedrooms as the main sites for procreation in 2 or 4 decades from now. Professor Greeley argues that parents will be able to select embryos that are disease-free and have traits they want for their offspring, and we welcome Hank Greeley back to the Forum program. Good to have you here again.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
It's a fascinating book, and it brings up so many issues. I mean, political, legal, economic, religious. But let's, you know, I'm reminded, and I suppose you were probably as well or have been reminded about Huxley's Brave New World. This is Brave New World you're writing about here.
You know, interestingly, it is and it isn't. So I went back and reread Brave New World fairly recently. I think the first third holds up really well. The rest of it's a little weaker. But it brings it to mind. In fact, the processes Huxley talked about really weren't similar to this. He didn't know about DNA. They weren't doing genetic sequencing. But the idea of manipulating our offspring is the similarity, the common chord between Brave New World and this. But the other thing I like about Brave New World is, you know, the title came from The Tempest, from Shakespeare's
yes.
Tempest. Miranda says, "Oh, Brave New World, it has such people in't." And what people rarely remember is her father Prospero then says, "'Tis new to thee." And I think a lot of the issues here are not new issues. What makes it new is the urgency, the fact that this is, I think, I predict, going to happen fairly soon and in a specific way so we can begin to actually take concrete actions to prepare.
Yeah, you're a bit of a soothsayer here, and we'll talk about what some of those concrete actions are. But we have reached the point, I mean, and there's a lot of new advances, innovation, technology, and so forth. We've reached the point where, you know, you get some sperm donor and a little piece of skin, and you're in business because of stem cells in large part.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my book argues that two different biomedical innovations coming from different directions and not really propelled by reproduction are going to combine here. One is whole genome sequencing, cheaply. It's gone from $500 million a genome to about $1,000 a genome, and it's still going to get cheaper. And the other, and the key issue in moving to what I call easy PGD or easy pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is getting rid of egg harvest. Sperm donation, in one of life's many unfairnesses, has never been unpleasant or dangerous. Egg harvest is both unpleasant and dangerous, and it's really expensive.
But you're talking about this whole pre-implantation thing being not only easier and less expensive, but it also ties in with in vitro fertilization also being not as onerous as it's been in the past.
Right. So most people don't know this, but we've been able to take a 3 or 5 day embryo, take a couple of cells off of it, test those cells, see what traits, usually just 1 or 2 traits that embryo has, and make a decision about whether to implant it. We've been doing that for 25 years. But to do that, you've got to do IVF because you need to know where the embryo is at day 3 or 5. And if you get pregnant the old-fashioned way, it's halfway down one fallopian tube. Good luck finding it. You put it in a petri dish. It's not moving around. It's going to be there. And IVF is a pain. So what I think is going to happen because of our drive to understand stem cells, we'll be able to take what are called induced pluripotent stem cells. So take some skin cells from you or me or Irene Noguchi or anyone else, turn them into these pluripotent cells, cells that can become any cell type, brain cells, heart cells, liver cells, but make these into eggs or sperm. And that is going to make IVF much, much easier, much cheaper, much less dangerous. And that, I think, is going to lead to what I call easy PGD.
And you've also got now a kind of in your futuristic, not that long from now, maybe even as close as a couple decades, the likelihood of DNA-based embryo selection. So you go and you get 100 embryos and you decide, well, I want these traits or I want to see that these genetic diseases are not part of the package or whatever, and it becomes a selective process.
Yeah, I think we will see increased and broad use of embryo selection. I was careful to set the time frame at 20 to 40 years. And my advice to people having bold predictions is set the end date beyond your life expectancy.
But you know things can move much faster than that, Hank. They often do.
They can move, but I can't be proven wrong in my lifetime, I don't think. But I think we will actually see a world where most babies born to people with good health coverage, wherever they are in the world, will be conceived in the lab. People will make about 100 embryos. Each of those embryos will have its whole genome tested. And the prospective parents will be asked, you want to know about really nasty early diseases, other diseases, cosmetic traits, the little bit we can tell you about behavioral traits, boy and girl. Tell us what you want to know, and then tell us which embryo you want.
This can bring down healthcare costs, at least potentially, the way you're characterizing it and describing it. It's also good for same-sex couples, isn't it?
Well, yes and maybe. I think it should bring down healthcare costs. And in fact, I think one of the advantages to it is that it would be so beneficial for public health and public healthcare costs that I think it would be provided for free. If it costs, say, $10,000 to start a baby this way, 100 babies is $1 million. If you avoid the birth of one baby with a serious genetic disease, you've saved $3 to $5 million right there. And 1 to 2% of babies are born with some serious genetic disease that could be detectable. The same-sex issue, I think that's going to work, but that's another jump. That would be taking a skin cell from you and turning it into an egg, or taking a skin cell from a woman and turning it into a sperm, or something that's sperm-like enough, doesn't have to do the whole long involved rigmarole that an actual sperm goes through in normal reproduction and regular reproduction. I think both of those are plausible, but that's more than plausible. I think they are probable, but that hasn't been done yet. Turning skin cells into eggs and sperm has been done successfully in mice, and there are mice pups born as a result.
By the way, when you use the word rigmarole, it reminds me of something I read in The Mirror, which is across the pond. I guess you had your 15 minutes of fame over there.
Yeah.
They were talking about avoiding the rigmarole of the rumpy pumpy. That's so Brit, you know. In other words, you don't have to go into the boudoir and to procreate. But the fact of the matter is, this is not the end of sex. I mean, it's a title that grabs you. This is the end, because recreational sex will probably always be with us. It's the end of, possibly in developed countries, sex as a way of procreating.
And frankly, this is a prediction. I'm not making a normative statement one way or the other, or not mainly. I think it will be not the complete end. I think people will still get pregnant the old-fashioned way, sometimes for religious reasons, sometimes for philosophical reasons, sometimes for romantic reasons, sometimes because they're teenagers and the backseat of the car is there. But I think most people will come to reproduce this way. It's the end. And there's a bad pun in the title. Any pun you have to explain is a bad pun. It's the end of one end of sex. If you think about purposes, goals, functions as ends, it's the great diminution of reproduction as the purpose and the function of sex. Yes, we will. I'm very confident about this prediction, Michael. I think we will continue to have sex in all the ways that we and Bill Clinton can define it well into the indefinite future.
This is what's been called prophetic scholarship, and Henry Greeley is our guest. I'm not sure if it's utopian or dystopian, like I told him, but we should also say that the book is not only The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction, but that Hank Greeley is founding director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences and a law professor at Stanford. And also, you got a connection to the genetics department there at Stanford. But you haven't had a biology class since 10th grade, I read?
We could barely spell DNA. But I remember dissecting the shark, but that's about all I remember from 10th grade bio.
I actually have said, I gave a talk to the Department of Surgery at UCSF recently, and I said, although at one time I thought I might want to be a doctor, it was the dissection in the human anatomy class of a fetal pig and all that smell of formaldehyde that did me, maybe a little hyperbole here, but it certainly turned me off.
But you know, I'm not trained in biology, but as an adult, I came to it late, and I find it deeply fascinating. The first third of the book is trying to give people without a biology background enough information about genetics and IVF and reproduction and stem cells to understand the book. And that's hard to write. But my hope is that it will convey to some people my enthusiasm and maybe bring them to a love of biology too, because it is incredibly complicated, wonderful, fascinating, ridiculous, and a great way to spend time.
But there's a kind of shadow over this in some ways, and let's talk about – I mean, a lot of people talk about playing God and all that concern, but before we even get into that, there's this whole thing that comes under the rubric of consumer eugenics, and there is a eugenics fear when we start talking about selection and all.
There certainly is, and the first third of the book's about the science. The second third is about the social factors that I think will lead this actually to happen, which many people are surprised about. But the last third is what the issues are. What concerns we should have. And my goal in writing this book, other than to work out an idea I had, I mean, it's really written for me as much to satisfy my own curiosity as much as anything, but it was to give people the pluses, the minuses, what the issues are, to help them make up their own minds. Eugenics is a slippery word. It means many things to different people. To some, it's state-enforced reproductive control. To some, and what we had was state-enforced sterilization. To some, it's any kind of reproductive choices. But those are different things. For me, I think the coercion is much more important than the issues of selection. The concern about the state or the insurance company or someone else forcing you to pick particular babies worries me a lot more than having parents make choices, though having parents make choices raises its own set of questions.
Yeah, and some of those questions are pretty profound. Let's at least talk about them or broach them now. I mean, what do you see as particularly the biggest question here? Of course, it's often characterized as designer babies and all the rest of that sort of thing, and we've gone through those moral pluses and minuses many times on this program, but what raises the hackles for you?
So I think the hardest questions here for me are the fairness questions. It's the equality questions. It's not so much designing ourselves. And there is an important distinction here. The process I'm talking about is selection, not design. With the rise of what's called CRISPR, a new gene editing technique, I had to rewrite part of the book because designing becomes
– to catch up with CRISPR.
It moved forward at least a decade in my thinking, although I still think selection will come first. I think the equality issues are deeper than how we should pick, in part because we don't know enough to make super babies. We're not going to make X-Men this way. We'll make babies who we can be confident won't have one of 5,000 or 6,000 nasty genetic diseases, maybe less likely to get Alzheimer's or cancer. Maybe we'll be taller or shorter, hair color picked. But this is not a species – right now at least, and for the foreseeable future, it's not a speciation event.
Do you assess Shostak said about this after reading your book? You know, Seth, he's here in the Bay Area. He's, I think he's still head of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He said, you're talking about maybe a new species, transforming the species.
Yeah, so I think CRISPR is more likely to transform the species by editing things to make them different. This is just picking what we've got. So if my wife and I decided insanely at our ages to have another kid, we wouldn't be able to get anything other than what we bring to the table through this method. And what we bring to the table, if you pick the right part, you know, if you hit everything right, you get a little bit better, but it's not going to be, I don't think, a speciation event. Given that, what I worry about is some people will be able to use it, some people won't. Some people will choose to use it, some people won't. If I'm right about the economics, in most places –
well, you're saying it's going to be cheap.
Yeah. In most places, I think it will be subsidized, so it will be free. But, you know, I worry about the dilemma of Republican legislators in very conservative states, where on the one hand, they want to spend as little money as possible on Medicaid, on health care for the poor. But on the other hand, they don't like the idea of making and not using a lot of embryos. I could imagine a state saying, we're not going to pay for this via Medicaid, which would mean that the roughly 40 to 50% of babies born in that state who are paid for by Medicaid wouldn't get to go through this. And although they're not super babies, adding another 10 to 20% health advantage to the babies of the rich over the babies of the poor is a bad thing. Even in countries that make it available for free, it's going to be a long time before this is available in the Central African Republic or Laos or Paraguay.
It's mostly developed countries we're talking about.
Yeah, and rich people in non-developed countries.
Yeah, I mean, yep. There's that class difference or that difference in income too.
Yep. So the global inequality will exist regardless of what the whether there's inequality within a developed country.
Some big questions here that we're hammering out with our guest, Hank Greeley. And I'm going to open up the phone lines now. What you think about in terms of this forecasting of the end of sex or at least the future of reproduction, because in just 20 years, according to Hank Greeley, most people in developed countries won't have sex to procreate. And that's what he as a bioethicist predicts. It's a future where, again, skin cells can be used to make an embryo and parents would prefer a baby made in the laboratory rather than the bedroom, although some may take that all traditional style, as he suggested here. There are ethical questions. There are legal questions. This may indeed be our reproductive future. I'm interested to find out what you, our listeners, have to say. And I'm going to open the phone lines and invite your calls now. Toll free, you can join us at 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your involvement in the program with questions or comments or concerns or perhaps even some idealism attached to this. Your calls are welcome. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Looking at a comment here from Tim Hank, he says, I'm very concerned about the increased reliability on laboratory science to reproduce our species as it appears to be becoming commonplace. I am curious as to what your guest thinks about this putting our species at risk of extinction without the use of laboratories.
That's a really interesting question. And there, it's one of a couple of really long-range evolutionary questions. I think that's not such a big deal in this context because using the lab doesn't make the old-fashioned way go away as an option. So 10 generations down the line, the fact that those 10 generations may all have been conceived in the lab doesn't mean that a male and a female from that 10th generation couldn't get together the old-fashioned way and make a baby. Unless, of course, people selected for that. It is an interesting issue with respect to medicine in general. We now have lots of babies who are born who would have died before forceps, before cesarean section, before modern surgery. And in a way, we are making our species more reliant on the continuation of good medical care. This particular one, I think, is not vastly important in that context. But the overall natural selection adapts to your environment, and our environment today includes modern medicine. You put us in an environment that doesn't include modern medicine, and some of us aren't going to make it.
Darwin didn't foresee much of this, though, did he? Really? You talk about natural selection.
Well, you know, Darwin spent a lot of time studying pigeons, which was unnatural selection. I think Darwin did know that humans can change selection. We can be part of the selection pressure, and our culture, in part, creates the selection pressures that turn us into what we are.
Let's bring our callers into this. Let me begin with you, Ada. You're on the air. Ada, are you there? Alda. I'm sorry. I thought I saw an L as an I. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So great talk. I'm curious, though. It's pretty obvious looking from our reproduction debate in the U.S. that the U.S. is going to drag its feet on this for a while. But there are a lot of other countries like, you know, the U.K., China, South Korea that are pretty open to not only gene selection, but also cloning technologies. I was wondering, is this just a technology where we're going to see other people dive in first and see how it looks before our debate moves forward, or are we really going to take the lead on it?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, there are real big national, political, and cultural differences here. Yeah,
I think that's going to be an enormous issue. I actually think we are likely to be, despite the strong right to life movement, we're likely to be an early adopter. We are the least regulated developed country with respect to IVF because even though the Vatican doesn't like IVF and even though right-to-life people shouldn't like the wastage of embryos through IVF, they like babies. They like people to have babies. And with between that sort of a libertarian background in the U.S. And what we've seen and the growth of a very profitable, very savvy fertility industry, I think we will be an early adopter, but I don't think we'll be the first. I do think some of East Asia in particular will find this very interesting. On the other hand, Germany, because of its historical background, has been very reluctant to do anything in human genetics. And, of course, the Vatican City isn't likely to legalize this anytime soon.
Yeah, you mentioned the Vatican and IVF. I mean, they've been pretty adamantly opposed, even though they may like babies or love babies. And the fact is that the ease of IVF for taking away all these formidable obstacles and difficulties that have been associated with it is just going to make it all the more pervasive and maybe make the Vatican more in opposition, even with Pope Francis.
Yeah, predicting the Vatican is even harder than predicting American politics.
I was thinking the same thing, or even predicting human reproduction. Let me get another caller on here, and let me go next to this is Corey. Hi, Corey.
Hi. I have 2 points I wanted you to address. One was, if you're looking at sci-fi, I would really look at Gattaca, because it describes a society where most people are doing this option.
Forgive me, Corey, but I think it's come up a lot with Hank Greeley's book, hasn't it?
Gattaca's in there, but
okay.
When you finish your the second part, yeah. I'll address it, because I think there's some interesting things about Gattaca.
Yeah, the second part is we've had clones of animals that are completely different from the parents, and it's been because of hormonal or environmental or, you know, things that we're not fully understanding yet. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Sure. Let me take the second one first. I'm a parent, and when I give talks about this, I ask how many people in the audience are parents. A lot of the hands go up. I ask them how many had their kids turn out exactly as they expected, and no hand ever goes up. To be a parent is to live with uncertainty, mystery, and surprise, and that's not going to change very much. You might take a little bit of the surprise out, just as ultrasound can tell you boy or girl. This could tell you boy or girl. This can tell you won't have Tay-Sachs disease, won't have trisomy 13, won't have a gene that would lead to early onset Alzheimer's. But there's a whole heck of a lot that it won't tell you about, because we are much more than just the sum of our genes. That's an important part. But environment and I think chance plays a huge role. And I actually kind of hope that if this happens, one of the things it will do by a very vivid, concrete demonstration is help people understand that genes are less important than they think when they see that the kid they picked to be Andrew Luck instead wants to be an architect.
We're coming up on a break. Gattaca. So, I always think of Uma Thurman, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Ugly cars, clunky phones, that's what I noticed most recently, but more on that later.
All right, and we'll have more with Hank Greeley. And you, again, you can join us at our toll-free number if you want to weigh in here. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. As we continue to talk about the end of sex and the future of reproduction, you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Hank Greeley. He's founding director of the Center for Law and Biosciences and a law professor at Stanford, and the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction, about which Paul Berg, Nobel laureate and recipient of the National Medal of Science, says, "Will the future confront us with human GMOs?" Greeley provocatively declares yes, and while clearly explaining the science, spells out the ethical, political, and practical ramifications. And this is Judith Darr from the Whittier Law School, who says, "Greeley has written an exceptional book. Anyone interested in the technology of human reproduction and what it holds for humanity's future will thoroughly enjoy the read." Well, as long as we're talking about future, we were talking about Gattaca, and we had a stray thought there, a thread to pick up.
Yeah. So I recently rewatched Gattaca, and it is funny to see the future predicted from 20 years ago and what the cars look like and what the phones look like. But I think the most important part about Gattaca, and the reason I'm not quite as worried about it, Gattaca itself shows that the society that it envisions was foolish. They put lots of emphasis on the genetic predicted traits, and yet our hero, without the predicted traits, turns out to be great. And one of the people who did have the predicted traits turns out to be a scumbag, more or less. I don't think our societies are likely to discriminate based on genetic information in that way, that thoroughly, because the genetic information just isn't that useful for the things we care most about.
But we've shifted toward, it seems to me, I mean, it used to be a lot of emphasis on nurture rather than nature, and there's definitely been a shift, hasn't
there? Yeah, it's a pendulum that swings back and forth. But I do think that the public as a whole, fed, I'm afraid, by some over-the-top statements by a few scientists and get amplified by the press, thinks that genes are more important than most geneticists think. The reality is, if the question is nature or nurture, the answer is almost always yes.
I've got a question here from Colleen, who tweets, and we're getting a number of questions along these lines. She says, please have your guest address the tech's role in the dangerous history of sex-selective abortions. China comes, of course, immediately.
Right. Although it's not just China, and it's spread in places beyond Asia in ways that are kind of interesting. I think when I talked earlier about equality and fairness being one of the biggest issues for me, one of the parts of that is sex selection. This would make sex selection possible. One of the questions that people will have to answer, both for themselves and for their countries and cultures, is whether they want to ban sex selection, whether they want to use sex selection personally, whether they want to ban it overall. In the U.S. so far, although the information is largely anecdotal, it looks like sex selection is not a significant issue. People pick about evenly, but that's not true in every culture and may change in some cultures. There's a little bit of good news in the East Asian front. In at least a few places that had very, very bloated boy-girl ratios, those are coming back very close to normal. So South Korea used to have about 120 boys for every 100 girls. 104 or 105 is normal. More of us get born, but we tend to die earlier. They're now down to about 106 and 107, even though their laws haven't changed. So I think it's definitely something to watch. It's one of the points I identify where regulation might be appropriate, and different societies may make different choices about regulation, just as different parents may choose to pick a boy or pick a girl or
talk about where else you see regulation as possible.
So one of the really hard issues
almost like conceivable.
For me, you know, one of the real problems with this topic is the puns, the unintentional puns are
endless.
Are fecund, are fertile, are
there you go again.
Yep. Although that one wasn't quite unintentional. Another area I see for regulation, obviously one is subsidies and price, whether you make it free for everyone, whether you subsidize it for people who can't use it. But I think there's a really big issue about disabilities. And that will play out different ways in different countries. I can imagine some countries saying to parents, we will not let you choose an embryo that will have a severe disability. We will not let you choose to transfer for implantation, pregnancy, and birth an embryo that would have Down's syndrome, for example, if when born. On the other hand, although in general I trust parents to do the right thing for their children more than I necessarily trust governments to always get it right, there are a lot of parents out there, and some of them are crazy.
Some of them shouldn't be having kids, frankly.
Right, right. So if a parent wants to have a child with a serious disability, is warped or crazy enough to want to have a child with Tay-Sachs disease, who will inevitably die within 3 or 4 years from a degenerative brain disease, awful, awful disease, should we stop that? But if we stop that, if there are deaf parents who want to have a deaf kid, should we stop that? Or achondroplasics, the most common of the little people, think of the Munchkins from The Wizard of Oz, who want to have a child like them, who want to have an achondroplasic child. Achondroplasia is not a terrible disability. It's a relatively minor disability as such things go. Would government, if the government gets into the business of saying these sorts of disabled embryos can be moved, these can't be, it's a dangerous slope. On the other hand, the idea that parents would intentionally have a child with a terrible disease is repugnant.
We are going to go to your calls. And again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. We're talking to Henry Greeley, the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Reproduction. And we'll go to you, Lorraine. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, my name is Lorraine. I'm from Santa Cruz, and I had a daughter who did die of a rare genetic neurological degenerative disease.
I'm sorry.
She died when she was 16, and so and she was hooked up with genetics at Stanford. And so my question is, you know, what do we do about a first world country society that can now choose to not have all these things? And what do we do about compassion? Because one thing my daughter taught me is compassion. It made me be really involved with special ed, where there's tons of compassionate people and compassionate doctors. And then, you know, all the way from, I don't find it repugnant that someone would have another child like this. I wouldn't. But what do we do about all the life lessons those people teach us? And then can we assume, what about if someone can take this all the way to, okay, I'm not going to have a child because I know they're going to be homosexual. Like, what do we do about a society that doesn't learn compassion ever because we've just gotten rid of anything we don't like or differences in us?
Great question. And to me, these questions, particularly around disability, are the hardest questions in the future, the hardest questions raised by this. I mean, imagine a world where there's almost no one born with a particular genetic disease, but a few people would be because they were conceived the old-fashioned way and no prenatal testing was done, or the parents chose to have them despite the disease. In a world where that disease is much less common, where's the research support for that disease? Where's the social support? Where's the medical support? Where's the possibility of stigma as people say, well, you should never have been born. Why did your parents make such an irresponsible choice? Or the possibility of somebody suing – of the child – of lawyers for the child suing the parents for making that choice. I think the status – the issues around disability are really hard, even before we get into your good point about – the lessons of compassion and such that the disabled teach. I will say this technology will not make disability go away. People will still get hit by buses. People will still have terrible diseases that don't have an easily predictable genetic cause. We will have plenty of opportunities for compassion. Human suffering will continue. It'll just be a little less.
Listener, sort of dovetailing with that, writes, so this is Felice, this says, I agree with the guest in terms of the concerns he's voiced about the implications of this technology in terms of access, disparity, and basic human fallacies. That being said, I can see this being incredibly valuable for couples who are carriers of serious hereditary health conditions. One of my sons is a carrier of sickle cell traits. By choosing what traits and problems to focus on, say sickle cell versus IQ and height, can scientists and ethicists have some say in the direction this research takes?
Scientists and ethicists can have some say. I think the bigger say will be parents voting with their feet, so to speak, and regulators. You could have a system that said we will allow this to be used to avoid serious genetic diseases, but will not allow it to be used for behavioral traits. Although, of course, drawing that line can also be tricky.
Well, in fact, you have the four categories of embryos, right?
Well, yeah.
I mean, as you foresee or envisage this.
Yeah, five sorts of issues that parents will be asked what they want to know about. Really nasty early diseases, other diseases, cosmetic traits, behavioral traits, and boy or girl. And you could have a regulation, and one of the things I ask my readers to think about is what kind of regulatory scheme, if any, would they choose? So you could say you can use it for some things. You can't use it for other
behavior
things.
Behavior gets really messy. Doesn't it?
Yeah, and my guess is that behavior – I mean, what we know right now is all we know about genes and behavior is genes that cause really, really, really bad behavior. We know how genes can make people intellectually disabled. We know effectively nothing about genes that make people smarter than average or better at math than average. We know plenty of genes that will make them worse at math than average, or plenty of genetic changes that will make them worse.
So, do you agree with my metaphor for all that, that it's a casino in many ways? I mean, in terms of the distribution and what you can expect from that distribution?
I mean, it is now, and so what you're doing – or I like bell curves.
Okay.
So, and of course, you know, rolling dice, rolling two die produces a bell curve,
yes,
with seven in the middle. And I think that what this would do is shift the middle of the bell curve over a little bit, but not very much. So it's kind of like I don't gamble in casinos because in the long run the house wins always. Well, this changes the odds a little bit and gives parents a little bit more ability to have children who have – who at least don't have certain diseases. You're never going to be able to guarantee your kids are going to be healthy. There are all sorts of terrible things that can happen. Being a parent is a lifetime of terror.
Well, as Dr. Johnson put it, you're always a hostage to fortune.
Yep, and kids are hostages to fate.
And here's another caller. Amy, join us. You're on.
Oh, hey, can you hear me? I'm in my car.
Hear you fine.
Okay, great. So my understanding is that we are already in near-term human extinction and that abrupt climate change is going to drastically change the ability of the planet to support life in terms of water, food, methane in the environment, and all of these things. So I'm wondering, like, how is climate change fitting into this in terms of being able to genetically modify humans to survive, you know, what's coming with abrupt climate change and the methane from the ice cap and less water, less food, that kind of thing? Can we create humans that don't need as much water and food to survive and can, you know, breathe a different combination of atmospheric gases? And I'll take my answer offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the question.
Interesting question. I think this is a good point good moment to point out again two different approaches to this. Embryo selection, which is what my book is largely about, is a technology that's been around for 25 years and has important but somewhat limited safety issues. That only lets you get out what you've got to put in. So you might be able to change water needs or tolerance of high CO2, et cetera, by selecting variations that are already in the population. That would be somewhat limited, but it's conceivable. It's possible. It's plausible. Gene editing using CRISPR or other techniques would let you do completely new things not seen in humans before. The safety issues there are mind-boggling in terms of being confident that you're not making a profoundly disabled baby who, after all, didn't volunteer to be the product of gene editing. But gene editing would, moving into a more science fiction science fiction-like context, give more flexibility to adjust to a changing environment. I will say, though, that although I think our species is going to face a lot of problems, the 7.3 billion of us, I think, are unlikely to go entirely extinct. We're like cockroaches and rats. We're survivors. So
they're better survivors, so I think, aren't they? At least the cockroaches.
Well, we're all pretty good at it and similar in ways we don't like to think about.
As you mentioned CRISPR again, and here's a listener named Nick who writes on Facebook, how will CRISPR be implemented? What will be the next step in what you described about choosing embryos? Will it be choosing an embryo and enhancing it, or does the enhancement need to happen before that with a sperm and an egg?
So that's a huge and important question, and it's one that's been talked about a lot lately. In 2015, it was kind of the year of CRISPR. A couple of important high-profile pieces came out in Science and Nature. I was one of 18 authors on one of them. And then the National Academy of Sciences, in conjunction with the Chinese Academy of Sciences and the Royal Society of the UK, held a big summit meeting in early December of 2015 to talk about human germline modification using CRISPR. All of those things came to the conclusion that we shouldn't do anything yet. But that, except for continued basic research, mainly because of concerns about safety, I think I agree with the safety concerns completely, and I think those safety concerns are going to be really hard to deal with. And my hope is that every country will regulate, and my expectation, almost every country will regulate the use of CRISPR to make inheritable changes in humans very heavily. Frankly, my worry is we're not going to regulate heavily its use to make inherited changes in mosquitoes or E. coli or dogs or other things. And that, I think, is a much more immediate problem. But longer term, CRISPR to modify humans, if it's proven safe, is an issue that we're going to have to confront. My guess is it'll be 10 or 20 years after the issues dealt with in my book, although I talk a little bit about CRISPR in the book.
Our guest again is Hank Greeley, and the book is The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. And the next caller is joining us from San Francisco. Alex, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I guess my question is, I'm wondering that you no longer see evolutionary pressures on humanity anymore. I mean, since And it's like in the past, nature's assurance for procreation was sex. the desire to have sex. And so now that people are choosing not to have kids, whether it fits their lifestyle or not, or just not into it, could you see a new pressure bred into humanity that the desire to have kids, just an innate desire, would become more and more common?
Interesting question. It's, you know, questions about how evolution proceeds are always sort of frustrating. Right now, we mainly look at them in the past, and we can tell stories that make sense, but proving them's difficult. Certainly, I could imagine a situation where we could find some genetic variations that were associated, hopefully causally, with a desire to have children, and parents could choose to try to put that into their kids. But with all behavioral issues, the influences of environment and environment, everything from prenatal environment to, God knows, high school and all sorts of things can vary that. You would think that natural selection would have strongly put in every human the desire to have sex with somebody that would lead to the birth of children. And yet we know from looking at our society that there are people who are not particularly drawn to procreative sex. So I think that the complexities of this behavior are really strong and not something we are likely to understand anytime soon.
You know, there's so much moral philosophy behind what we're talking about here. You wrote about someone being able to take your skin cells off a Coke can and actually make babies without your knowledge. I mean, can you talk further about the legal implications of this? Are you responsible for kids you don't know about?
Sure. I think that's actually one of the strongest recommendations I would make is we should make it illegal to for somebody to make you an unknowing parent. Right now, it's pretty hard to steal eggs and sperm. But I'm looking at the Diet Coke bottle at your right hand. That's got your cells on its top. And if I made off with that bottle when it's empty, in theory, in 20 to 40 years, I could use those cells to make you a father or maybe even make you a mother or make you both. And that's something I think we shouldn't allow. But they're one of the stranger possibilities here. If, in fact, you can do this with any kind of viable cell, you could take cells from dead people where the tissues had been preserved appropriately, thaw them out, and make those people into parents. Dolly the sheep was made from a cell that spent 4 years frozen.
Yeah.
So you could have women who are 80 having good eggs, girls who are 8 having good eggs, people who have been dead for 10 years producing eggs and sperm. Whether and to what extent we should regulate that, I think, is unclear, but it's an issue we need to start thinking about, at least some of us need to
start thinking about all these
about
issues,
it.
Hank.
I mean, part of why I wrote this is I think we need to start thinking about these yesterday. These are coming.
Or maybe even, as you said earlier, when you said 19 rather than 20, we should have started in the previous century.
Well, our fiction writers did to some extent.
Yeah, especially our science fiction writers. Here's David who says, are humans evolving? It seems to me that given our human-made environmental pressures, i.e. climate change and these developments in genetic engineering, we are, is the only measurement of evolution the genome?
No, depends on what you mean by evolution. For genetic evolution, it's only in changes in the genome, but cultural evolution happens and the combination of cultural and genetic evolution. Mark Feldman and Luca Cavalli-Sforza at Stanford years ago wrote a wonderful piece about how lactose tolerance, being able as an adult to digest milk, co-evolved with cultures. So cultures that started dairying, their genes began changing. We're still evolving. We still have selective pressures, but some of them are natural, quote, natural pressures, and some of them are pressures that our cultures create.
Let me go to more of our callers. Let's get Jessica on. Jessica, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, your guest today said that it's repugnant for parents to choose to have a baby if they know has a disability. So my question is, where does faith fall in that? As a strong Christian, I don't believe that God makes mistakes with babies. And so I have a lot of friends who have found out that their baby had a defect and chose against medical advice to give birth to their children. And today their children are amazing people doing amazing things in the world. And so I just wanted to know how you feel that faith, you know, plays a role in this whole conversation.
So first, I want to clarify what I said earlier. I don't think it's repugnant at all for a person to choose to continue a pregnancy knowing that the child will have a disability. And I think, in fact, one of the most important issues is preserving parents' rights to make these choices. What I do think to me is repugnant is if you've got 100 embryos and 99 of them are healthy and one of them would have Tay-Sachs disease, a parent who chooses intentionally to have the baby that's going to have this painful, terrible, early demise, that to me at least is repugnant.
You know, this was done by a couple who were working in a Hasidic community in India. They were working on behalf of people who were, for the most part, impoverished, and they were doing really wonderful work, but they were trusting in God in terms of – there was definitely a Tay-Sachs gene, and they decided to have the child because of their trust in God.
And I have no objection to rolling the dice that way or letting God make the decision, depending on your beliefs. It does bother me to have a parent say, I intentionally want and choose to have a baby who will die before he or she is 3 or 4 years old after a terrible disease. That human agency, it's actually taking the divine or the chance out of it and substituting a human agency that affirmatively chooses terrible suffering.
This couple was killed, by the way, by Pakistani terrorists. In terms of what God's plans are, you have to ask that question.
And we will never get rid of all the sources of suffering.
Here's Vicky, who writes, if men can have children via artificial wombs, women will be as unnecessary to them as men are for choice moms. According to post-genderism, the belief that men and women should use advanced gender-neutral biotechnologies to reduce the gender gap and create entirely new opportunities for sexual expression, we'd be much freer to explore both our masculine and feminine sides if our bodies and personalities were no longer constrained by gender traits.
Well, I talk a little about the artificial womb in the book. The good news from my perspective is I'm pretty sure that's beyond my lifespan, because thinking about the possible ramifications, which are enormous in both like almost every technology, good and bad. And I would note, by the way, the science fiction author who's influenced me in this area is Lois McMaster Bujold and her Vorkosigan series that includes uterine replicators.
And can I mention one of my favorite authors here? Because
sure.
Samuel Beckett claimed that he remembered being in the womb. Now, what would it be to be in an artificial womb? Would your memory be the same?
Question's difficult to answer, Michael.
So I
think the artificial womb is actually plausible in 50 to 100 years, and society will use it in ways that I can't imagine, that I'm sure will have both good and bad possibilities.
Here's Kurt. Kurt, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Fascinating conversation. Obviously, any rational human being is going to choose not to have their child born with Tay-Sachs or cancer or Alzheimer's. But what if we had the option of tweaking the genetics to make an immortal human being? Would that be something society would tolerate or a parent would choose?
That's a really interesting question. There's a bioethicist at Oxford named Julian Savulescu who argues in favor of moral enhancement. If by drugs or implants or other things we could make people more moral, not only should it be allowed, but it should be required. I bridle at that. And yet I'm a parent. Mine are now 27 and 24. But when they were little, it was my duty to try to manipulate their morality, to give them some morality. It's our job to change them. And one of the things, and this also comes up in some of the other contexts that I think is so interesting about this topic, if deaf parents wanted a deaf kid and they had a hearing kid and they deafened the child, they go to jail and the kid is taken away. Is it different when you choose beforehand? If we try to instill morality in children after birth, that's normally fine. If we try to pick genes to make them more moral before birth, is that different? Is that infringing on their freedom in some different way? That, to me, is a really interesting question. The good news in response to your specific question, I think I can duck it because we don't have a clue about what genes or genetic variants lead to morality, even those of us who have a strong sense of what morality is.
Although I'm also struck by the whole question, not talking about morality, but also mortality. I mean, can genes be manipulated? Got Ray Kurzweil and people like that now trying to extend their longevity and look to ways in every fashion, biotechnologically particularly, to extend mortality.
Well, out of a database of, you know, now about 10 to 15 billion people who've lived over the last 40 or 50 years, we've got exactly one person who made it past 120. Jean Calment from France made it to 122. And with that big a group, that I think tells you what the genes we've currently got can probably best do. You might be able to squeeze a little out, but interestingly, nobody else has gotten even to 120. So I don't expect the genes we've got to give us immortality. I'm skeptical about whether any gene changes can make us immortal. And I have my doubts about whether it'd be a good idea or not. But that is beyond the end of sex. It's the end of sex, not the end of death.
Well, it's a fascinating book, The End of Sex, and many fascinating questions. Always a pleasure to have you on, Hank. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Michael. I enjoyed the conversation.
Hank Greeley, founding director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences and professor of law at Stanford. The book, again, is The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. You can continue this discussion online, by the way, by going to kqed.org. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.